Okay, everyone. Welcome to our event tonight. So I'm going to be introducing the Free Speech Movement educational programs, and then our speakers will introduce the panelists, and we'll go from there. And so we'll have our three speakers, then we'll have a question answer afterwards. We'll be wrapping up that at 8 o'clock. So my name is Jason Schultz. I'm a chair for the Free Speech Movement educational programs. So we do have some literature about if you want to set up a panel. We're actually very interested in having students, undergraduate, graduate students, do set up programs like this. We have about 2 to 3 per semester. We also do have faculty folks that do set this up too. So if you have a faculty, you have Berkeley affiliated folks that are interested in putting together a panel, please do. We have a website through the library. I'm not going to list it off because it's kind of long. But if you have interest in setting up a panel on any topic, the information, which is right here, this poster, this flyer is actually at the front, and you can go check out our website, apply online for that. There is funding that is given for student organizations. We also provide the food, and the recording and everything else is taken care of you. Care for that. So just be aware of this. We're really happy to have any programs that are interesting, that are dealing with issues of free speech or dealing with any other topics that are related to campus life, history, Berkeley life, current topics that are listed related to free speech movement. This is obviously a very timely topic we have today, knowing your rights before the strikes. So I'm going to wrap it up with that. I'm going to give it over to Kelly and introduce the program. Thank you for coming out tonight.
Alright, hi everybody. My name is Kelly Fabian. I'm your student advocate. And so I'm from the student advocate's office, and basically we're a branch of the AACC who represents students when they have conflicts at the university. So we're always available to help. We're located in 204 Eshelman. And I actually interned at the ACLU over the summer, which got me inspired to contact Berkeley's ACLU and get an event going for the protest. So with that, I'll hand off to Berkeley ACLU.
Hi, I'm Jeanette Ling. I'm the internal co-president for Berkeley ACLU, and...
Hi, I'm Isabel. I'm the external president for Berkeley ACLU this year. So I guess I can talk a little bit about Berkeley ACLU, and Jeanette's going to tell us when we usually meet. So if you guys are interested in joining Berkeley ACLU, you'll know where to find us. So Berkeley ACLU, we're basically a campus chapter of the National American Civil Liberties Union. We co-sponsor a lot of events like these just to get awareness out to the campus community. So things we're working on right now are online privacy rights. We're working on Prop 19, Yes on 19. So if you guys are interested in any of that, definitely come find us.
We meet weekly, Wednesday nights from 6 to 7 and 179 to 1000. And you can always find us on Facebook.
So the purpose of tonight's event is to bring together our two groups and bring together all the groups that would be involved in a typical protest. So we have Chief Salaya, Chief of UCPD, Linda Lai, who's an attorney with the ACLU, and Jeff King, who's an attorney with the First Amendment Project. And then we also have Summer Shaw, who's from the Student Advocates Office. And each one of these speakers is going to be speaking to you about either the rights of students in a protest, how UCPD would approach a protest, just the different aspects of a protest. And then after every speaker speaks for about 10 to 15 minutes, we're going to have all the speakers sit up here and questions from the audience will be encouraged. So you can ask anything you'd like. And with that, I think we're going to introduce our first speaker, Summer Shaw, from the Student Advocates Office.
Good evening, everyone. I didn't know I was going to get a mic, so let me make sure everyone can hear me and everything. I'm going to get us kicked off with a little discussion very briefly on the rights that are relevant to students that are going to be protesting and demonstrating on October 7th. And it sounds a little bit louder now. And also go into detail on two specific processes that our office helps out with that are relevant to our topics today. The first is the UCPD complaint process, and the second is the Center for Student Conduct and the conduct process. So to get started, as Kel mentioned, I'm the Chief of Staff of the Student Advocates Office, and we serve as the campus public defender. And as a result, we've long been involved in the forefront of issues involving students' rights and conflicts with university policy. Our goal tonight is not to foolishly attempt to instruct you on how to act on Thursday. Our goal is instead to provide you with the information necessary to make informed choices. and also to educate observers on how to act when they witness any instances of misconduct by UCPD or by university officials. So, to get started, basically, if many of you might have seen the email already sent out today discussing the university's free speech guidelines. The university has a lot of accommodation for students, and students are allowed to engage in a robust form of free speech and demonstration on campus. They draw the line, however, at activities that can be considered illegal or activities that would incur damage upon university property or curtail other students' rights. However, past experiences and the events of the last year have shown that that line is not clearly demarcated and that there are certain gray areas. And in those gray areas, it's important to have keen observers, especially students, making sure that university officials and UCPD are following protocol correctly. So in that situation, the best form of action is to be a keen observer and take down important details, including the time and place of the action that you feel is controversial, and even the name and badge number of the officers involved, so that you can create a proper report for the situation. If you find yourself engaged by a UCPD officer, you have the right to ask if you are being detained. If not, you can walk away, and if you are being detained, you have the right to ask under what reasonable suspicion you are being detained. Keep in mind that if you are detained, an officer can subject you to a pat-down search. However, he or she has to arrest you if he's going to search you extensively, including your belongings, and such as bags. If you do feel that you have been wrongfully arrested, or if you have witnessed police misconduct, the best way of acting is to file a police complaint with UCPD. Police complaints are overseen by a specific unit with UCPD and also overseen by the Police Review Board. Keep in mind that police complaints must occur within 30 days of the incident occurring. Our grievance division, as part of our office, has caseworkers that are specifically trained to help students who are interested in making a complaint of this sort. If you do end up being cited for a violation on Thursday, keep in mind that violations that occur on campus or within a couple blocks of campus can be handled by two different processes, including the traditional legal system and our university's code of conduct, which is administered by the Center for Student Conduct. UCPD will forward such violations to the Center for Student Conduct, and if they determine that the case is worth pursuing, they'll issue you a notice of possible violation via email. Students that are faced with the code of conduct process can pursue it either informally or formally. We encourage students to first start by pursuing the case informally, by working with a conduct officer to come up with an agreement that is suitable to both parties. If the student is unhappy with both the procedure or the outcome of the informal process, they have the opportunity to pursue a formal hearing in front of trained faculty and students. If they're unhappy with that faculty with that formal panel's decision, they can go ahead and pursue an appeal as well. It's important to note that although the conduct process is very different from the traditional legal system, students should be aware of important rights that they possess. Among them include the right to a notice of charges for students involved in cases. Additionally, they should come into the process with the presumption of innocence. It's important to note that there's a very big difference between the legal system and the code of conduct process, in that conduct officers will determine the responsibility for students for being responsible for a violation based on a 50% rule, which is a lower rule than the traditional legal system. And the rule works such that the officer must determine whether or not it is more likely or not that the student committed the violation to be found responsible. Finally, students also have the right to not participate in the hearing and also to be accompanied by an advisor throughout the process. Our office's conduct division has trained caseworkers who can help and assist students who are involved in the conduct process throughout its entirety as well. Typical resolutions that come out of the conduct process start with the most lenient, which is a warning, which creates a conduct record for 7 years that can affect graduate school and government employment prospects. It goes upwards to disciplinary probation and also suspension, going further to dismissal and in some cases exclusion from university grounds. Our office has dealt with the Center for Student Conduct for many years now, and when we've come up with issues where we feel like students' rights have been infringed, we've brought that criticism to them. I'd like to talk about a few of those issues today that are relevant to today's topics. The first of which is one that we've advocated on in the past and continue to advocate on, and that we assert that the students' violations not be judged based on the political nature or the content of the violation itself. In those situations, we feel like officers cannot use the content or the political nature to assess more scrutiny or to consider the violation more harshly. Secondly, we've taken issue with the university's suspension of the conduct timeline, which is delineated specifically in the code of conduct. The university suspended the timeline due to duress caused by the budget cuts and inability to make sure that those deadlines are met. However, we've seen that it's led to undue burden in some cases to students whose cases have gone on for very long periods of time and affected their academic well-being and other issues as well. We're going to be taking these issues along with many others to the table in the upcoming code of conduct revisions process, of which we will be a party to. So we'd encourage you to bring any suggestions or concerns to us as well that we can bring to that process as well. Keep an eye out also for a public forum that we'll be holding on code revisions to make sure that the campus as a whole is included in the process. And I think we'll get the rest of the speakers. Next we'll have Jeff Kingsby, and he's, he's the First Amendment Project's attorney, and he's going to be speaking specifically on the importance of media rights in these times. Next.
I'm actually not just a staff attorney at First Amendment Project. I'm the former co-president of Berkeley ACLU, so it's kind of cool to be back many years ago. And I'm also a documentary photographer. I focus primarily on protests. The first picture, the first news event I ever covered, actually, right outside your guys' offices in Sproul Hall, sit-in on the first day of the Iraq War, March 20th, 2003, and actually 119 people were arrested. Ultimately, I think that was in the internal student code of conduct system as opposed to the penal system. I would just add on to the suggestions with dealing with the police, one more thing, which would be you have a right to remain silent. Given recent Supreme Court case law, you should actually invoke that right specifically. You should actually say, I invoke my right to remain silent. You also have a right to an attorney if you're if they try to interrogate you in custody, and that as well should probably be specifically invoked. There's two different cases, Miranda and Edwards, respectively, the Arizona. So I'm going to talk about something that has become much more salient in recent years, which is the right to document police actions and or newsworthy events. And it's become more salient because technology has changed. We're being recorded right now, and I imagine there'll be many, many, many recording devices of various sorts in 2 days. You have a First Amendment right, whether you're press or just public, to document newsworthy events, to document police actions. The Ninth Circuit has already ruled on this, and that's actually true even if you're a participant. Now, what that means is that the police cannot retaliate against you or arrest you, for example, specifically for exercising your First Amendment right to gather information or disseminate it to the public. That doesn't mean that you can otherwise commit a crime, such as an assault, or vandalism or something like that, and then say, well, I was recording it, and you can get away with it. Don't call me if you do that. Although if you didn't do that, then they accuse you of that. So there's actually one very sort of esoteric exception to that that I don't really think is going to come up. It has sort of come up in a few places in the country and so far has failed. And that is officers citing in a state where there's a wiretapping provision that calls for all party consent. Sometimes officers have said, well, you're recording audio, and I have a reasonable expectation of privacy, say they're on the side of the road or something like that. Well, it's actually come up on public streets, and I'm arresting you. When really, it's been somebody documenting police activity. I think that's an extremely thin argument. And it recently resulted in the dismissal of the case in Maryland. I think it's sort of working its way through the law enforcement subculture, but I think it's really going to fail. And, the bottom line would be, don't be sneaky. If you're going to record openly. You cannot obstruct an officer, even if you're filming. You can't physically be in the way. They ask you to back up, you should back up. If you're too close for comfort. For example, when I'm shooting at a protest, I will actually sort of check my physical body language to some extent and just sort of present a non-threatening presence and just sort of, you know, deal with people politely, say hello even, that helps to sort of not put them on edge because they're obviously outnumbered most of the time, but in any event, you can't be in the way. if the police give a dispersal order, there's actually two ways that you can get in trouble just for being in a place, and this includes press. One is if they declare an unlawful assembly. It's a very specific part of the penal code. It sort of goes back to the old, like, reading the Riot Act idea. They can actually order, under certain circumstances, everybody leave except them. However, they have to order it. They have to give you fair notice, and you have to be able to leave. It's a misdemeanor to stay. And that counts for press, it counts for, you know, the Chronicle, it counts for New York Times, it counts for Daily Cal, that counts for protesters. But what they can't do is say, you know, we're going to detain you on suspicion of unlawful assembly. Because that means they're detaining you for a lawful assembly. They have to declare that it's an unlawful assembly. And then you've got to get out of there. They can, however, in their discretion, allow you, say, press to stay if they want. The other would be 409.5 of the Penal Code, which it allows press to stay at a disaster or accident scene. I think it's calamity is the word that's used. However, if something's declared a crime scene or an unlawful assembly, then you do have to leave. Or you can be arrested and actually convicted of a misdemeanor for not leaving. But for the most part, you have a right to be there. Until that declaration comes down, you're not in the way, you're not. And you can actually cross police lines if you're press. You have to be press. And it's an accident or disaster. But something like an unlawful assembly, it's not going to work. And these are all sort of falling under the right to news gathering, and I'm going to talk about the right to control your work product and not be commandeered by the state. Not have the police essentially deputize you, the news gatherer, into acting on their behalf. And the one last thing I'll say about news gathering is if people do get arrested, another right, there's a very nice inmate locator at the Santa Rita Jail website. It's actually a public record of who's in jail, so you know the police can't secretly arrest people when you're not American. And so, what's that? No demo. And so they're very, they're good about having a website. So what I really want to focus on, and I'm going to try to be brief, but this really important stuff, is the right to control your work product. For example, can a police officer say, as happened when Oscar Grant was shot in some of the videos, you can see the BART officers running toward the trains. Give me that camera, we want the camera. Can they seize your camera like that? And the answer is no. If they arrest you, they can seize what you have on you incident to arrest, but really they need a subpoena or a search warrant to get your journalistic, not your journalistic, but your what you're doing. However, that's highly qualified because they really can't even get those. And really, subpoenas are the only way that they can go, and I'll tell you why. First, there's a qualified First Amendment privilege. It's complicated. It's weaker. I'm not going to talk about it. It falls under the First Amendment. Specifically, it's a constitutional provision. But under California law and under federal law, for the past 32 and 30 years, respectively, there have been laws preventing the police from, say, taking those photographs of a newsworthy event and using them as evidence of the crime. One would be, and this would fall under a subpoena, the California Shield Law, Evidence Code Section 1070. And it says, if you're connected with a news organization, it lays out who is, you have an absolute immunity from being forced to turn over your photographs, your notes, anything like that, any unpublished information to the police. Absolute immunity. I don't care if it's a murder and you just witnessed it. If you're reporting for the Chronicle or the Daily Cal, as long as you're reporting for a news organization at that time, they cannot get it. The feds might get it too, but under state law, it's an absolute immunity. The only exception to that under law is a criminal defendant's Sixth Amendment right to get a fair trial. So if there's exculpatory information that's going to free them, they can override that. But then there's a balancing test. You can actually, it's a status test, so you do have to be connected with some sort of news organization and actually acting in that capacity. But you can actually be like a freelancer, for example. You'd be connected with an online publication. All of those would count. And if you weren't connected with such an organization, it would fall back to the qualified First Amendment privilege, which is sticky and weaker. And the one I really want to talk about, and I'll talk about briefly, are search warrants. Police cannot get a search warrant for information, barring extremely limited exceptions, information that you're gathering for distribution to the public. There are two laws that are relevant here. And they're passed in the wake of Zurcher v. Stanford Daily. I will pause for hissing. And that was actually a protest where there's a student protest at Stanford in the 70s, and the police actually raided the Stanford Daily newsroom for the photographs, and the Stanford Daily brought a First Amendment challenge, and the Supreme Court said, look, the warrant provisions in the Constitution are specific enough, it's an otherwise valid warrant, First Amendment doesn't block a warrant. But state legislatures, Congress, if you want to pass some laws, might not be a bad idea. So immediately, California did. Actually, it was an urgency measure that same year. And then a couple years later, Congress passed the Privacy Protection Act. So California appealed for 1624G. 1624 governs search warrants generally. Subsection G says no search warrant shall issue for any item or items described in Section 1070 of the Evidence Code. Remember, that's an absolute privilege for people connected with a news organization, whether it's indie media, Daily Cal, doesn't matter. That, again, is an absolute privilege, and it was invoked in a recent case I'm going to talk about for a second, and then or a couple recent cases, and also in the iPhone 4 Gizmodo search warrant case. I don't know if you guys heard about this. We were actually involved in that. The other protection is the Privacy Protection Act. That doesn't actually, it's actually a qualified statutory privilege. That's a federal law, but that allows you to sue the police if you're news gathering, really gathering information for dissemination to the public. And that actually does not require that you're connected with a news organization. That just means, you know, I would argue that if I'm taking a video of police arresting somebody and I want to put it on YouTube, all it requires is a reasonable sort of reasonable belief by the officer that that's what you're doing. So you just say, look, I'm doing this for public consumption, I'm going to publish this, and you can sue them for damages if they seize it. It's federal law, 30 years old. And finally, I actually want to, and I'm sorry to ambush you, talk about why this is important, because the ACLU is actually currently suing UCPD officers for violations of the Privacy Protection Act. They participated in a joint raid with the FBI and allegedly searched a newspaper's offices, and are currently being sued for damages. We actually just concluded a First Amendment project, successfully concluded litigation in which the UCPD had responded to the vandalism of the Chancellor's house, in which the Chancellor and his wife were inside. Obviously a very unpleasant situation, but our client, who is a veteran 42-year-old journalist, has been covered hundreds of events, never had a major problem with the police in any of these things, was only covering it, told the police multiple times, six times in fact, that he was covering it, showed them a press pass. They told him to shut the fuck up because he wasn't a lawyer. They didn't care about his press pass. They arrested him. We got the warrant quashed under 1524G, all copies returned or destroyed, and a declaration filed with the court stating that no other copies were being retained. Those images had actually been used. And this is why the search warrant provision is so important, because a subpoena, if you subpoena somebody like that, it's connected with, in this case, indie media, they're going to go to court and say, hold on a second, I'm a journalist judge, here's the evidence, the judge is going to go, fine. Similarly with a search warrant, except that a search warrant is what's called ex parte, so the police can actually go in on their own and they get it, you don't have a chance to say anything about it. The UCPD's police report said multiple times, he claimed to be a journalist, he showed us a press pass, he claimed to be a journalist. When we arrested him, by the way, those charges were dropped immediately, when we arrested him, he waived his Miranda rights, which you should not do, and said, I'm a journalist. And they said, we don't, it doesn't matter. But the search warrant affidavit to the judge actually left all of that out and changed my client's behavior from he was coming down the stairs, like basically walking toward the police to document the arrest, to he was running, so actually misleading the judge. So another judge actually quashed the warrant and ordered, which is actually pretty unusual, quashing the warrant. So that's why these things are so important. That's why it's so important to know your rights and or contact an attorney if your rights are violated. And they weren't in this case. Sorry.
All right, so thank you very much. Next up. Next up, we're going to have the chief of UCPD, Mitchell Salaya, come go ahead and talk. And his relevance to today's event is obviously doesn't need any introduction at all. So he's going to go ahead and talk generally about UCPD and about their involvement on Thursday, and about the history of free speech, etc.
Thank you, Simone. I really want to wish to thank the Student Advocates Office in Berkeley and ACLU for inviting me for this opportunity. In some regards, the police department's responsibility is pretty simple, pretty straightforward. It's to maintain the peace and ensure public safety. Easier said than done, particularly when it comes to demonstrations. You know, one of the duties of the police department is, particularly when we're approaching a demonstration or responding to a demonstration activity, is balancing the rights of everybody involved. And I think that that's kind of the key there, because everybody has rights in the situation when we are approaching a demonstration. The individuals that are protesting, whether it be, you know, picketing, leafleting, marching around, have a right to do that under the First Amendment. But there are other individuals that come into play, there are parties to it that also have rights. And one of those parties being the university, and the other party being faculty, other faculty, staff, and students. And so, as our response to this, it is to weigh all those to ensure that everybody's rights are upheld. And one thing about First Amendment rights is that, although broad, they're not absolute and they're not unlimited, and there are some restrictions. And typically the restrictions come into play when the rights of one individual who's protesting start infringing on other people's rights, whether it's a student trying to go to a class, or whether it's, you know, professor trying to hold a class, or the university trying to conduct its mission into research and academic in classrooms and things like that. And I think that's the crux of it, as far as trying to resolve that, and trying to resolve that in a safe manner. And it is a challenge, but that's one area in which there are limitations to First Amendment expression of freedom of speech and those kinds of rights. The other one is protected speech. There are some speech that's not protected. Speech in which individuals, whether they're on, regardless of what side of the protest they're on, speak about or encourage others to commit a crime or provide hateful speech. Speech in which they're degrading or eliciting negative comments like gender bias, hate bias, type things, but more specifically, speech that incites other people to act in a violent manner, to commit a crime, whether it be a simple act of vandalism or throwing a bottle or to take over something, that crosses the line in which freedom of speech, the rights are limited. There's one other area, which is the First Amendment allows for governmental agencies to determine time, place, and manner rules. Many of you that are staff or students are aware that the campus has campus rules and regs. Part of those regs, regulations, are time, place, and manner rules, in which they designate certain areas in which they restrict certain types of activities and speech because it's disruptive to the mission of the university or individuals trying to do their jobs or go to school. So those are some areas for that. So my message for everyone that plans to participate in a demonstration or protest is to familiarize yourself with the rules and regulations of the area that you're protesting, and to ensure that the act itself isn't a time, place, and manner issue, that it is isn't a violation of the law, such as trespassing. And when it comes to protests, you know, when a building is closed in the middle of the night, and someone goes into the building, that would automatically is trespassing. During the daytime, it's a little bit different. This is a public institution, the buildings are open, people enter the buildings. And quite often here, what we have is rallies and marches. Groups will march around through campus and they'll go through buildings. Some of the exceptions to the buildings, if they're research buildings, because then there's a higher sense of security and they're locked down. But other areas, such as libraries or classrooms and a lot of the office buildings, are open during the daytime, and we've allowed people to march through buildings. You know, the police do not determine when there's an actual violation of law as far as a trespass associated with a sit-in. We look to the building coordinator or the the campus administration, or if it's a classroom, the professor. When an individual or group goes into a classroom, the professor is in charge of that area. They get to determine when something's disruptive or reached a level in which they're asking for the police to remove individuals. The police do not determine when that occurs. We make contact when we get called to that. We make contact with the individual, whether it's a professor or the dean or a member of the administration, to determine what their tolerance level is, what is the activity infringing on other people's rights to continue with the class or activities of that building. And once that decision is made, then they look to the police department. The police department is charged with enforcing the campus rules and regulations, local ordinances, federal and state laws on the campus. And so in doing that, again, it's going back to communicating those with the individuals protesting so they know what the consequences are and they know what any violations are, whether it's a campus rule and reg or whether it's a state law. And the idea is that individuals there make an informed decision. They make an informed decision regarding whether they want to continue their activity or whether they're going to leave. And there's a process. Yeah, my colleague, you know, talked about unlawful assemblies. You know, when there is a sit-in during the daytime when the business is open, or the class, the building is open itself. Once it's determined to the police that the disruption has got to a level where it's unable to continue with this business and asking us to remove people, we give them notice. And we give them notice by declaring an unlawful assembly, which is basically, you know, commanding them to leave and advising them what violations of law exist. That it's trespassing, that it's disrupting a public meeting, if there's other acts, if there's other violations of law, then we would share that. And as a matter of practice, is we provide notice more than one time. Typically, it's three times. That is a practice. It's not a statute that says you need to do it three times. But the idea is to provide notice so people know what the violations are and know what the consequences are and know that it is crossed the line. And then arrests continue in trying to remove the individuals out of the area. The vice chancellor, the chancellor, put out a notice about how to protest safely. One of those things, and one of the bullet items, in addition to what I've talked about, is about following instructions. That there is it is unlawful, a misdemeanor, to not follow the lawful instructions of a police officer or a public official. So it doesn't have to be a police officer, it could be a public official. And that would be like the chancellor, the vice chancellor, someone that owns or controls the area. And so, you know, whether you agree with it or not, you know, if somebody gives an order that you are disrupting or on disruptive activity, you are not trusted, you need to leave, it is your obligation to leave. And typically that is a misdemeanor and it requires you to obey. If you don't, then that's when the police department typically gets called and to resolve that. One of the safety things is when you're involved in a protest is to not engage in not just disruptive behavior, but criminal behavior. These situations typically are very emotional. People feel very strongly about that. And whether it is an act of vandalism, whether it's spray painting or breaking, you know, a piece of property or someone else's property, that is vandalism and that is a criminal act and that is not protected. And so, you know, if you're in a group, as an individual with other people who are doing those kinds of things and is declared an unlawful assembly, you may be arrested as part of the group. And this is a nuance for police as far as dealing with protests and demonstrations and doing their normal jobs. When we are out patrolling, typically it's a one-on-one situation. We're dealing with an individual. You know, when it comes to demonstrations and protests, you're dealing with groups and you're dealing with group activity. And when you declare an unlawful assembly, you're declaring unlawful assembly to a group. And it is our charge to try and make sure that every member of that group understands, you know, when the time has come when it's declared an unlawful assembly. And that is sometimes easier said than done. It is usually done with by voice commands, through bullhorns. At times it's done by handling leafleting. It's by going through advisors and things like that to try to get the word around to individuals that in fact a mayor has been called an unlawful assembly. And when that does happen, we usually have contained the area to make sure that other people aren't joining in, because if they join in later, then they may not have heard the dispersal orders. They would not know that there's a violation of the law. Now, one of the, I think, things as I think back about protests and demonstrations is trying to, and balancing the rights of everybody involved, to share with everybody that everybody has rights. And that, I work in a very, unique and diverse environment, and one of the best environments that you can be in as far as diversity, but also as far as the tradition here. And the tradition of freedom of expression, expression of your rights, freedom of speech. I mean, when you look at Berkeley, this is the place to be. This is where a lot of that came to be. And it is also unique because this is a public learning institution. And it is a, being a public environment, typically, particularly with student protests or union picketing, things like that, is everybody is, there's an affiliation with everybody here. Unlike going elsewhere, where if you are at a dock or a business where you have people picketing, the police go there. There's no nexus between the police and the individuals participating in that. Here, it's a little bit different. Here, there are either our faculty, staff, and students. We see them as student protesters or represented picketers from staff or faculty. And so it's a little bit different than one. And so we try to put ourselves in a position to work with the groups to allow them to express themselves, to protest, to picket, while at the same time balancing the rights of the university, but more importantly, the other faculty, staff, and the students in particular. So I kind of want to focus on the safety issues, because the end result is the last thing I or my organization wants to do is an arrest a faculty, staff, or student. That is not in our best interest to do that. You know, we would much rather work with the students in identifying dialogue and leadership as far as, keeping people informed as far as what is acceptable, what's not acceptable, what it means. In the past, we've worked with groups and facilitated, allowed them to demonstrate, and when they've decided they wanted to be arrested, because some groups have decided, we feel so strong about this, we want to be arrested, we want to prove our point, we want to show our commitment to this cause, and so we facilitate the arrest. And it's done in a safe manner, in a manner that that they accomplish their goals and their means and their objectives. And that's what I would like to see as far as working with groups on campus and off campus when they're coming on to express, because we do draw in this institution individuals who want to come to campus because it is a great platform to express their concerns, whether they're university related or not. With that, I want to save some time because I think that the value is answering questions and addressing any comments or questions that the audience may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. And our final speaker before we go to, as Jusalai said, the most important part of the question-answer phase is our esteemed attorney from the ACLU, Linda Lai, and she is specifically specializing in free speech and protest issues, I believe, so she'll be able to give us some good expertise on these issues.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here tonight, and also the other speakers, actually. I think, we have a very similar perspective, and I'm really delighted to hear that, so I'll try not to be too repetitive. I wanted to cover two main topics. The first one is the scope of your free speech rights as protesters, as protected by the First Amendment. And then in the second half of the presentation, also touch on what happens and what you can expect if you engage in conduct that is not protected by the First Amendment. So let's start with the First Amendment, and I thought we'd just basically do a who, what, where, and how of the First Amendment. Now first, who does the First Amendment protect you from? It only protects you from limitations on your speech by the government. It does not protect you on some random private individual's effort to shut you up. Now, you're all at UC Berkeley, and your school, your educational institution, is a governmental entity, so you have a First Amendment right vis-a-vis Berkeley in that instance. So, best. So Berkeley absolutely does have to respect your First Amendment rights as a state actor. In terms of what does the First Amendment protect, the general rule is that the First Amendment protects speech but not conduct. Now the courts have come up with kind of a crazy third category known as expressive activity. So it's this sort of hybrid thing. That receives First Amendment protection as well. So if you're burning a flag, you're engaged in conduct that you're trying to send a particularized message, and it's pretty likely that the person seeing what you're doing would understand that you were trying to communicate a message. If you're engaged in what the courts call expressive activity, that is also protected by the First Amendment. But the lines get sort of blurry and somewhat arbitrary in my view. A famous case from the Vietnam War era, someone was burning his draft card, which, if you ask me, seems like a pretty particularized message, but the court in that instance found that it was conduct, and it didn't make it enough. It didn't get the protection. So the speech-conduct distinction is often a little bit hazy. So the general rule, the government, if we're dealing with speech, the government cannot regulate what you say, but it can regulate how you say it. So in terms of not regulating what you say, that protection is really broad. The government cannot get, it's very difficult for the government to try to engage in what we call content or viewpoint-based regulations of what you say. It can't say, you can't talk about the state budget, you can't criticize President Udall. Those would be content and viewpoint efforts to regulate your speech, and the UC would have a very, very, very difficult burden to try to get away with that. Now there are a few important exceptions to the general rule that the government cannot regulate what you say. Chief Celaya referred to one of them, that's incitement of imminent violence. Let's take an example. President Udall doesn't represent students, let's demand the regents fire him. There's no sort of incitement of imminent violence there, that's protected speech. President Udall doesn't represent students, let's go firebomb his house now. Okay, that's a bad idea, that's not protected, that would be incitement, don't do that. Chief Celaya also referred to bias, sometimes speech that has bias that could be read. I have a slightly different view on that. As a general matter, just because someone is going to be offended by what you say, that does not strip your speech of First Amendment protections. This is what we call a heckler's veto. Just because someone is going to be upset and they're going to heckle you, that doesn't strip away your rights. The classic case that the ACLU brought was the right for Nazis to march in Skokie. You know, this caused tremendous hurt and offense by the local Jewish community. But the Nazis absolutely had a First Amendment right to express their political views. It's somewhat more nuanced in the educational context, which is obviously what we're dealing here. There, the educational institution has a right to regulate speech if it would pose a substantial or material interference with the educational environment. So in those situations, there might be, this is when you can, what Chief Slaw was saying about, hate speech codes, bias codes, given the special unique nature of the campus environment, UC may have a little bit more latitude to regulate language that causes offense if it poses a substantial material disruption to the campus, to the educational environment. But if we're just dealing outside the educational context, then this, there's no heckler's veto. Another category of speech that is not protected is true threats, so similar to incitement. This is an expression of an intent to commit an act of unlawful violence. That is not going to be protected. Also, defamation is going to have limited protection under the First Amendment. What is defamation? It's a false statement of fact that adversely harms someone's reputation. So keep in mind that opinion is not defamation. Governor Schwarzenegger is a terrible governor. That's an opinion. That's not going to be defamation. Governor Schwarzenegger embezzles funds. That's an assertion of fact. And that may become defamation. There's certain protections in the First Amendment context about whether you can actually be held liable for defamation if it's a public figure or a matter of public concern. But as a general matter, defamation isn't entitled to absolute protection. Obscenity is also not protected under the First Amendment, but I'm not going to get into that. And so the general rule, remember, speech is protected, conduct is not. In terms of the how and where of the First Amendment, it applies on government property. So with a few exceptions, malls in California, most private property, you don't have a First Amendment right to engage in speech there. Again, if you're talking about doing a protest on the UC campus, that's public property, so the First Amendment does apply. Now, the government is going to have more or less authority to regulate depending on the specific nature of the property, and Chief Scalia alluded to that. If we're talking about Sproul Plaza, that's going to be what's known as a public forum. These are streets, sidewalks, public parks, areas that have traditionally been open to speech. You know, UC Berkeley has a fantastic history, especially on Sproul Plaza, of opening that area up to public speech. And it's the speaker's corner. That is a public forum, and speech has to be allowed there. The government can only regulate speech there subject to time, place, and manner restrictions. Those are permissible there, some regulation, but there's absolutely no regulation of content in a public forum. Now, there are other types of UC property that are going to be somewhat different. For example, the UC Office of the President, that is not an area that has historically been open to all manner of public expression. So if UC wants to just ban speech from there, they probably have a pretty good reason. They probably have a pretty good justification for doing so. What they cannot do, though, even in non-public fora, like, for instance, the lobby of the UC Office of the President, is exclude groups based on viewpoint. So they couldn't say, okay, only people who support fee increases are allowed to speak. We're going to keep out all people who oppose fee increases. That would be viewpoint discrimination. And even in a non-public forum, like an administrative setting, a research setting, etc., that's not going to be okay. So to sum up, basically, speech, the government cannot regulate what you say, but it probably can regulate how you say it. I'm going to try to keep this brief because I could go on and talk about this for a long time. Some brief things to keep in mind about conduct. If you engage in activities that are not going to be protected by the First Amendment, you can be subjected to discipline, either within the internal UC proceedings or potentially in the California criminal justice system. So this is often referred to as civil disobedience. Chief Scalia was referring to this earlier. What is civil disobedience? It's a conscious refusal to comply with the law as a form of protest. Now, even though your intent here is expressive, like the guy who burnt the draft card during the Vietnam War, your intent is to protest. Civil disobedience is still not protected by the First Amendment because it involves conduct.
You mean our numbers, how we outnumber you, and, well, that would index democracy. Wouldn't you think so?
Well, some of it has to do with, depending on the situation, what the officers are doing. The officers, if they're on a line in front of a barricade or holding an area, have a job to do. And quite honestly, as my colleague said, is that these situations, they typically are outnumbered. You know, it could be anywhere from, a dozen officers to several hundred to 1,000 individuals that are in front of them. And it's a difficult position for them to be in, and these are very fluid and dynamic situations. But the intention is to always gain compliance at the most lowest level.
If you haven't gotten the point yet, I'm actually referring back to November 20th of last year. And I'm sure you'll forget what happened that day.
So actually, if we could, on that topic, maybe we could give an opportunity. I apologize that most of the questions have been towards the chief, but maybe if you could take a couple seconds at least to talk about what UCPD and what the administration in general has taken and reflected from the November 20th, and how that would apply to October 7th. Any comments on that?
And maybe give a brief overview of what did happen on November 20th for people who weren't there that day, so they would know. Police conduct.
That's a lot of material to cover in 10 minutes, but if I could focus on the police review report, there was a rope work.
You said that UCPD messed up on that day, I'm pretty sure. That they used an excessive use of force.
What you talking about the letter that I wrote, it said I acknowledged that there was a number of things that we could have done better. That I acknowledged that the communication wasn't to the standard that we are accustomed to providing, that without the use of PA systems and bullhorns, that they're just yelling in front of a line is not sufficient, and providing instructions of what we're asking the people to do as far as whether it's to stay behind the barricades or not, with the simple...
Well, that's UCPD incompetency, isn't it? That you
Sorry,
don't even have
I just, if, I think Chief Salaya is just answering the question. So if you could just, we do want to get to other questions as well. So if you could just keep the question to the video, if you could just continue with your thought and then we can move on to other questions. I apologize. It's been a really meaningful dialogue, but we'd like to give everyone an opportunity to ask questions, and I saw others answer this as well.
Well, as I was saying, I think that there was clearly room for better communications, not just between the police department, people on the barricades, and the protesters outside the barricades, but also internally and between the police department and the administration. And we put a number of things in place to do that by putting some processes and procedures in place to ensure that there's real-time communication going back and forth. And it was a difficult day, a difficult situation. There was a lot of information coming from inside Wheeler Hall that was just false as far as what was going on inside. When it was calm and there was not a lot going inside, even when the arrest, it was very subdued as far as, you know, when we got inside, we made arrest, there was no physical confrontation whatsoever. But the information coming out was that we had been tasering people, we had been doing those things, and my officers don't carry tasers, and a lot of that, I believe, had an impact on getting the motions up of the crowd outside. And it was taken out on a lot of things the officers were trying to do that day.
Hey, yes, this question is for Chief Talai as well. You mentioned, so you mentioned that your officers don't carry weapons that fire rubber bullets, but I read with great interest Internal Review Board report that came out earlier this year, and in fact it states that a student was shot on November 20th with a rubber bullet. So I was wondering how you explain that, and then as a follow-up, if the answer is that you called in other forces through mutual aid, taking this latest question very seriously, I don't care who actually fires the rubber bullet. So I think taking her question seriously and treating it with respect it deserves, how are you going to ensure that students on this campus who are non-violently protesting aren't hit with rubber bullets? I don't care who fires the thing, but who aren't shot with rubber bullets, since you're on the police review board.
Well, that singular incident was through a mutual aid officer that was from Alameda County. Partly as in our dialogue as far as the expectation philosophy when they report to us, partly is having the resources to prevent something from getting to the point or escalating to the point where you call mutual aid. When mutual aid comes in crowd control, they come in their tactical gear as far as a crowd control team. I think being able to manage that and have the additional resources early on to prevent it from getting that stage is what we need to do. A lot of attention has been focused, and righteously so, on the responsibilities of the police department as well as the administration. But I think that there's another component, and that is the responsibilities of the protesters. That we all have responsibilities as far as how the situation evolves and which direction it goes in. And so as much as I can put things into place and reinforce expectations as far as how we'll address it, the protesters also have a role to play as far as their conduct and behavior, in which the Care Review Report did acknowledge and share that within the protesters there was aggressive activity, there was spitting, there was throwing, there was kicking, there was some aggressive acts toward the officers. I don't say that resolves or addresses some of the issues.
But are you saying that this warrants a rubber bullet? I mean, and that's just how you ensure that rubber bullets won't be fired, it's not about
the protesters? Well, the rubber bullet that was fired was, as I understand, was an individual who they believed was coming over the barricade. It was just displaying some aggressive behavior.
It's on YouTube. I've seen it.
And you, in YouTube, there was like 160 or plus YouTube videos on six single events, and the YouTubes were edited to have snippets of what occurred. And I'm not, what it's shown on YouTube is there, but it doesn't also provide the whole picture.
So this question is for, I guess, anyone to answer. So if something, like if we were to get arrested or anything were like that to happen to us, like what steps should we take? Like what should we do? Like who should we call? And if they take away your cell phone and all, like all our numbers are now in our cell phones and we don't really memorize numbers anymore, how, like, do we have access to that? Or what should we do if that does happen to us?
Write down telephone numbers on your body. You have the right to three phone calls if you have child caring responsibilities. You have the right to two additional phone calls to make child care arrangements. Call a lawyer. I have a flyer out at the front on sort of civil, you know, like resources. The Ruckus Society, National Lawyers Guild, they have some sort of do-it-yourself help and sort of might help facilitate legal representation if you're arrested as well.
So we have about 10 more minutes for questions. So.
Hi, this is Ms. Lai, mainly perhaps for Chief Salai as well. I want to address the place of expression and the time, manner, and place. Who determines what an appropriate place is? You said that Sproul Plaza, for instance, has a long history of protests, but that was won by exactly what students and staff and faculty are doing now by occupying the place that represented the most power in the system at the time. So now we recognize it. The office of the things have shifted now. If I'm not mistaken, in 1964, the president's office was on campus, the UC president, and now that has shifted off campus. And most of the power is now centered in the office of the president and the regents, so that their venues would seem to me to have the equivalent status of Sproul Plaza. So the office of the president is a perfectly legitimate venue for protest and so on. I mean, I could go on. Yeah. But who establishes what the appropriate venues are?
So you raise an excellent question that points to this sort of circularity and illogic in constitutional law about whether something is a public forum or a non-public forum. Under the federal case law is defined by, you know, a very sort of fact-intensive inquiry about the history of that particular place and whether historically the government has allowed it to be open to all manner of speakers. Now, as you'll notice, that's completely circular, because if the government wants to shut off speech, it can just not let any speech there. And then if you do this public forum analysis, you look to whether the government has to shut off speech, and yes, they can continue to shut off speech. So it is circular, and it doesn't make any sense. Under the California Constitution, there is at least one case out there, and you know, it's a case that I think is really important, and it articulates a slightly different approach, which is basically looking at the, not so much what the government wants to do with the property or has done with the property in the past, but whether there's an inherently incompatible use of the property with free speech expression. And that case involved a protest at Livermore Lab in the parking lot. And there was nothing inherently incompatible about having a protest there. And the court said, yeah, you have to, you know, it's basically a public forum. So you're right to point to the circularity of it. The government gets to say it, and then we have to challenge it in court. And under the federal case law, if they say it, then they might win, unless they basically had it open all the time and then they're suddenly shutting it off. In that case, then it's an easy argument. If you're trying to sort of inject speech into a place where it's never been allowed in the past, that's pretty difficult under the federal law.
We have a couple more minutes for questions. And I think maybe while people are thinking, I had one quick question also to ask everyone on the panel, specifically the attorneys. The question, it has to do with the various points in times over the year, the university has invoked an idea that because this is an educational setting on the university, it is a little bit different from any other type of free speech. As the chief said, like on a dock or at a company for a strike, Could you guys talk about the validity of that claim and what, if there are any differences?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a well-established constitutional doctrine that in the educational context, the government acting as an educator has greater latitude to regulate speech. This came out of a case in a high school involving students who wanted to wear black armbands to protest, and could the school prohibit them from doing this? They had the First Amendment right to do that, tinker, but the court announced that in the educational context, the government could regulate speech if it poses a material or substantial disruption to the educational environment. So this is actually a pretty high threshold. They can't just say, "Oh, you know what? It's gonna, you know, this is, we don't like that speech. We're gonna shut it down." There has to be some showing of material or substantial disruption. It's greater latitude than the city of Berkeley or the state of California would have to regulate your speech, but it doesn't mean carte blanche.
All right. Well, I think one more question, if anyone has it. Or else, I think we are coming up pretty close to the time where we do have to close it down. So if any of you would like to make any final comments, or I'm not putting you guys on the spot, just the opportunity if we want to do that. Or else, I think we're good. I want to thank you all for bringing in the insightful questions. I think we had a pretty good dialogue here today. And I think we're all looking forward to Calcarian Knights' tradition of free speech and demonstration on Thursday. Thank you all.